Dear friends, the subject of our evening talk, followed by discussion, is the doctrine of the unity of nature. We have a devotional reading from the 7th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, entitled Devotion by Means of Spiritual Discernment, which is appropriate to the talk. It is a brief devotional reading. Let's dwell upon it for a while, which will prepare our minds for consideration of the subject. Krishna speaks, "Hear, O son of Pritha, how with heart fixed on me, practicing meditation and taking me as thy refuge, thou shalt know me completely. I will instruct thee fully in this knowledge and in its realization, which having learned, there remains nothing else to be known. Among thousands of mortals, a single one perhaps strives for perfection, and among those so striving, perhaps a single one knows me as I am. Earth, water, fire, air, and akasha, manas, buddhi, and ahankara is the eightfold division of my nature. It is inferior. Know that my superior nature is different and is the knower. By it the universe is sustained. Learn that the whole of creation springs from these two as from a womb. I am the cause. I am the production and the dissolution of the whole universe. There is none superior to me, O conqueror of wealth, and all things hang on me as precious gems upon a string. I am the taste in water, O son of Kunti, the light in the sun and the moon, the mystic syllable Om in all the Vedas, sound in space, the masculine essence in men, the sweet smell in the earth, and the brightness in the fire. In all creatures, I am the life and the power of concentration in those whose minds are on the spirit. Know me, O son of Pritha, as the eternal seed of all creatures. I am the wisdom of the wise and the strength of the strong, and I am the power of the strong who in action are free from desire and longing. In all creatures, I am desire regulated by moral fitness. Know also that the dispositions arising from the three qualities, sattva, rajas, and tamas, are from me. They are in me, but I am not in them. The whole world, being deluded by these dispositions, which are born from the three qualities, knoweth not me distinct from them, supreme, imperishable. For this, my divine elusive power, acting through the natural qualities, is difficult to surmount, and those only can surmount it who have recourse to me alone. The wicked among men, the deluded and the low-minded, deprived of spiritual perception by this illusion and inclining towards demoniacal disposition, do not have recourse to me." Now, the doctrine of unity of nature. You see the reading that was given from the 7th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, how relevant it is to the topic. Now, in this discussion, we have to consider the meaning, what we mean by nature. We have to consider what we mean by nature from two perspectives. One, from the common worldly point of view, or even from the point of view of science, what nature is. In that perspective, nature is physical reality, as science would put it. That's one aspect. Under this one aspect, we have to consider the unity of nature. The second aspect under which we have to consider the meaning of nature is metaphysical or ontological. Metaphysical on the ontological principles, with which modern science do not agree, but that does not matter at all. So, the suggestion is that in either of these two perspectives, when we make an impartial and keen observation around us and within us, in the light of both modern science and in the light of ancient wisdom, you clearly perceive that nature is actually one. Now, this will be the, and it has this very important bearing on our life, on our ethics, on our world ideal as a civilization. So, let's consider the subject of unity of nature from these two perspectives. Taking the first one, the scientific view, or even the common view of nature we all hold, what science calls as physical reality, what is it? It is the world or the universe or life which we perceive with our five physical senses: sight, hearing, touch, taste, and smell. What we know of the universe at the level of physical life is only this. One of the views of the philosophy of science is, modern science is, that this all is reality. This all is life of the universe. What is not perceived with the five physical senses is discounted. But however much you may disregard this other aspect of it, which cannot be perceived with our five physical senses, but which transcends, it, the other reality, the higher reality, which transcends the senses, cannot be discounted. It is the experience of modern science itself. Every one of its discovery takes it to the borderland of, you know, the borderland which separates the seen from the unseen, visible from the invisible. It cannot escape it at all. But only thing is, modern science is not able to take the courage to make that quantum leap to grasp, understand, investigate the invisible nature. Now let's take up the first aspect of physical reality of modern science, or common sense view of a world and life. Now, what we mean by nature is, we all agree, can be broadly divided into four kingdoms: mineral kingdom, the vegetable, the animal world, and the human. And if you take the mineral world, you will find that it is so diverse. You take each one of these kingdoms is very diverse. So diverse that no two blades of grass are alike. And how many blades of grass are there? Countless. And yet, no two blades of grass are alike. So nature always never repeats herself. Now, if you take the visible nature under these four broad categories, what does science say? Basically, they are all constituted of chemical elements. It used to be some 70 chemical elements in a periodic table. Now it is much more. And yet it is not exhausted. There may be still more elements not discovered. So all that we see of the physical reality, which science makes a clear distinction, divides them into two, as inorganic and organic, biotic, abiotic. In either case, if you take the whole of it, whether inorganic or organic, biotic or abiotic, they are all constituted of the same elements. Is it not? Weren't the same 70 or odd or 80 or 90 elements, which chemical elements which science has discovered, all that is there in physical reality is made up of these elements. So you see the unity of nature. Whether you take mineral kingdom, vegetable kingdom, animal kingdom, or human life, the bodies, the organic corporeal organization, it is made up of the same elements. And then, if you divide these elements, what do you find? They are made up of atoms. And if you divide atoms, they are made up of atomic constituents, the electrons, protons, neutrons, and so on. The difference between various elements and the composition of bodies which elements go to make, they vary from one another according to the configuration of these electrons, protons, neutrons, and all that. It is this, they call it atomic number, atomic weight, and so on. It is this which makes the differences, but essential constituents are the same. So you see here the unity of nature. Not only all that is there in our earth, it is an old science, modern science, that the spectroscope has discovered that it is the same elements also is found in the other planets and distant stars and galaxies and comets, asteroids. And it has been further confirmed by closer and keener observation through such technological advancement as Hubble telescope and various space explorations and so on. Even a distant comet, the same water is found as in Earth. So it is the same elements which make up the whole visible universe. Therefore, unity of nature. How did these elements arise? Science says that in the beginning of planetary evolution, all was in one molten mass, homogeneous molten mass. And then it cooled. And then in the bowels of the earth, differentiations occurred. And diverse elements arose. From those diverse elements, the various minerals, vegetable and other organisms were formed. So, there's one homogeneous substance from which these diverse elements have come, and all these diverse elements make up our organization. So, don't you see unity of nature here? Unity of nature from the perspective of what science calls physical reality. Now, let's go further. If you take molecular biology, every cell in the living organism is made up of the same constituents, whether you take the cell in the amoeba or the cell in the human body. The basic constituents are the same. And still further, every cell has a nucleole and a nucleus and the cell organization. And each one of us has the functions and beautifully coordinated functions take place in the cell. And various cells group together and a coordinated, organized function take place, and so on, from the organs and various organs acting together, make a coordinated composite, you know, action, concerted action towards a particular end. Now, if you go still further deeper, you find that each organism has its genetic code, and the laws of the genetic organization and multiplication of species is the same. The production of proteins by the DNA is the same in an amoeba or in human being. The same genetic laws apply. The same law of hereditary transmission applies. So you see here unity of nature even from the perspective of the visible, what is called physical reality. Now, let's consider the other one, the metaphysical and the ontological. Now, before that, there's one more important thing that we have to consider, and that is, science makes a distinction between organic and inorganic, biotic and abiotic. Now, when we come to the metaphysical aspect of reality, which is more comprehensive than the physical reality which science investigates based on the mere evidence of our five physical senses. It is far more than that. So it is much more comprehensive, which takes into account the principles such as life principle and mind principle and the spiritual aspect. So these are not seen by science, not yet investigated by science. If we take that also into account, we find that even there it is, you clearly perceive unity of nature. Now, from the perspective of metaphysical science, nature means an abstract nature. It's a very important point that we have to bear in mind. It is not nature that physical reality is seen and investigated by science. In metaphysical science, in ontological, on the based on ontological principles, its view is different, which we had a glimpse of it in the 7th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, which was read out. Now, we have been considering the basic fundamental propositions of theosophy in our study classes. Let's recall that. What does it say? If you take the manifested universe, it consists of the dual nature of spirit and matter. It consists of a dual duality of spirit and matter, subject and object. And there is something which links subject to object, that energy of ideation, dhyanchavanic ideation, which acts on matter and organizes it into manifested universe. So you have here the spiritual ideation, energy of ideation, and the matter which is organized by the power of this ideative spiritual energy. If we remember what the first fundamental proposition says, that spirit and matter are not two different independent entities, but they are the two aspects of one and the same. The two opposite forces acting in different directions produce a harmonious result. Now, spirit without matter cannot be even thought of. And matter without spirit would be chaos. So at every point you find spirit and matter conjoined together. There is no spirit without matter, no matter without spirit. And yet these two are one. Now, going further, recalling the first fundamental proposition, it is the universal substance, what we call matter, in its undifferentiated homogeneous substance aspect, undergoes a differentiation into seven grades. And it is the one and the same spirit which reflects itself in those seven grades of differentiation to exhibit various aspects of itself. So it's only at a certain stage of complexity of differentiated substance that the spirit reflects itself in such a basis or upadhi or principle to exhibit itself as I am I consciousness, the soul, individual soul. So if we bear this ontological principle in mind, you find that life is everywhere. Spirit is all-pervading. And spirit manifests itself in various forms, visible and invisible. And all the various forms are formed from the one and the same cosmic substance. And the consciousness and intelligence that the various forms exhibit come from the one and the same spirit. So you see here evidence of unity of nature. Now, the spirit descends into matter through a process of involutionary process. And after having reached the utmost point of differentiation, the spirit, which becomes, so to say, entangled in matter, struggles to free itself from the binding power of matter, and the spiritual evolution begins to take place. In the first case, it is involution of spirit and evolution of forms, matter. And after reaching the ultimate descent and a balance between spirit and matter has been reached, as we are now at present, then spirit begins to assert itself and free itself more and more from the binding power of matter. And that will be involution of matter, evolution of spirit. So this process is common in all the systems of the worlds, whether of the solar system, the part of the solar system, a planetary system, or any other solar system, a part of the galaxies and so on. It is the same. It is the evolution of spirit and matter. The matter, evolution of matter means evolution of forms, more and more complex and efficient, so as to form the instrument for the spirit to reflect itself in as individual soul and arrive at a complete understanding of nature as a whole and realization of its own self. So this is a common pattern everywhere. Throughout the infinite universe, this is the common law. Now, from this perspective, let's see what is the definition of nature. So different from what we understand by nature in the ordinary sense. Now, it says, it is from the Secret Doctrine, page 277, 278. What is called unconscious nature is in reality an aggregate of forces manipulated by semi-intelligent beings, elementals, guided by higher planetary spirits, Dhyan Chauhans, whose collective aggregate forms the manifested verbum of the unmanifested logos and constitute at one and the same time the mind of the universe and its immutable law. So this is the definition of nature. See, wherever you do, you take any mineral in its most elementary form, there is consciousness in it. You may not be able to perceive it, but there is consciousness in it. The very fact that it is vibrating, consists of vibrating atoms. How can there be a movement or a vibration unless there is life in it? So there is life and there is consciousness. And also in the mineral you will find a progression of more simple to more and more complex mineral forms in their beautiful geometrical structures and so on. And then from minerals to plants, there is a transition. If you carefully observe, you find that there is a distinct transitional stages from mineral to plant. At certain stage, more of mineral than less of plant. And a further, more of plant than the mineral. So, similarly, with the animal kingdom, from plant to animal. In the plant also, we have very elementary forms, and then gradually, you get more and more complex, and then most complex vegetable forms, which are even carnivorous and so on. Now, you find a very gradual transition from the plant to animal. So, you clearly see here there's an evolution going on. So, evolutionary law is the same throughout nature. The whole nature evinces a progressive march towards a higher life. So, the one and the same evolutionary law applies not only in the solar system, but also everywhere in every part of the universe, in every galaxy. It is the same law applies, unity of nature. Now, what are the implications of it? The implication of it is that there is vast difference in the development of intelligence, consciousness, from the lowest to the highest. There's a progressive developmental stages, and this is governed by law. And this constitutes the unity of nature. The implication of it is this, that such a uniformity of the constituents and the laws of progress and evolution, how can it that happen if there was not a fundamental unity of essential unity of all beings? Now, let's illustrate it in another way. When we say nature, this whole intelligent nature, in various degrees of development, or having a common origin, evolving under the same law, from the basic homogeneity to more and more heterogeneity, and going back to homogeneity. And in each case, in each such development, there is an accretion of more intelligence, knowledge and wisdom. So there is a perceptible growth following the same law. Therefore, the very important ethical implication of it is that no one organism or no one individual is separate from the other. We are all, the whole of the beings which constitute the universe are made up of the very same essence. This is what yoga philosophy teaches. Such important ideas that we must not forget at all. It says, the universe, including the visible and the invisible, the essential nature of which is compounded of purity, action, purity, sattva, action, rajas, and rest, tamas. The universe, including the visible and the invisible, the essential nature of which is compounded of purity, sattva, action, rajas, and rest, tamas, and which consists of the elements and organs of action. Why all this? It exists for the sake of soul's experience and emancipation. Now, we were in the morning, we were discussing this. Look at our, see, to make a picture of the whole universe from this perspective, all that we have to do is to see our own processes that take place in our body. It is a reflection and epitome of what takes place in the universe. Microcosm is a perfect copy of the macrocosm. Look at the marvelous complexity and the intelligent coordinated action that take place in our whole physiological process. Any injury happens to your hand, even a small cut, the whole immune system gets triggered. And what are all the processes that take place? If you have time, our doctor will explain here. Marvelous things. So the defense mechanism is immediately triggered, and the invading organisms are warded off, and the injury that has happened is healed. That's only an example of a simple cut that happens. Now look at the whole process that takes place in our body. Every one of the cell of every organ does its function, its dharma. And all acting together produce one common result. And every one of the organ, the liver, lungs, the heart, the circulatory system, the brain, the nerves, and every one of our limbs, they all, have intelligence. Every one of them is conscious. And every one of them has its own brain, though we may not see, has its own independent life, but all acting together under one law, one purpose. When disease, how does a disease occur? Disease occurs because of discord and disharmony in the performance of dharma of any one organ. This is Akash. The same case with the whole universe. Same case with the whole human family. Whole humanity. Humanity is one. Why there is so much of suffering in society, in world? Because it is analogous to the organs of our body not acting in unison and coordinated way. So disease occurs. If our whole corporate human world is suffering, it is because of this discarded disharmony. Now again, coming back to the body. All of these organs are acting together for what purpose? For a common purpose. What is that common purpose? It is for the purpose of the soul which is embodied in that body. The real man, the soul. That's why Patanjali says here, the whole universe exists for the soul's experience and emancipation. Difficult to imagine the universe. Imagine yours, the body itself. So, all this marvelous, coordinated, harmonious, purposeful functioning of the diverse organs of our body takes place by, for the experience of the soul, which is the body, and for its emancipation. This is a common thing throughout the universe, no matter what the beings is, whether invisible or visible, whether elemental or gods or humans, animal, plant or mineral. It's the same law, same purpose. The whole nature exists for the experience and emancipation of the soul. This is the teaching. So there's unity of nature, unity of purpose. Is it not? Now, still understanding it better, let's take up Sankhya philosophy. Now, ontological principles, you know, we mentioned ontological principle. How did these elements arise? Everyone must read Sankhya philosophy. It's very important. For a student of theosophy, the philosophy of Patanjali Yoga, Sankhya of Kapila, and Sankhya Karika of Ishwara Krishna, and then Vedanta Sara, and Shankara's Atma Bodha. These must be thoroughly understood. And then theosophy makes great sense. Now we speak of our great Indian heritage. Now, if we don't understand these, we will never understand our great heritage. Now, let's go to Sankhya. What does it say? How did this all arise? The modern science says everything came from, you know, the atom aggregating by accident and producing everything from bottom up. Ancient science, no sir, it is not right. Everything begins with spirit and comes to matter. Kapila Sankhya teaches that there is one homogeneous universal substance, which is called Pradhana, in which the three qualities of light, action and rest are in equilibrium. When the time comes, again time is another factor, Kala, cycle, then there is imbalance in the three qualities. And that's where the evolution begins. The first that appears from Pradhana is great universal oversoul, Mahat Tattva. From Mahat Tattva comes Aham Tattva. Now, where does your I am I consciousness come? Every one of us has I am I consciousness. It is not a product of the brain. It's not a product of the brain. It's nothing to do with matter. It is from universal oversoul, it is descended. It takes a god to become a man. Man is not a risen animal. He is an involved god in matter. Please remember this. So this aham tattva, ego. How many egos are there? As many egos as there are human beings on earth. Are these different egos different? No. No more are they different from one another and from the source from which they emanated, as the drops in the ocean are different from one another and different from the ocean. No more are they different from each other and the source from which they emanate than the rays of the sun are different from each other and different from the sun from which they radiate. So, the ego-ship arises in the universal O-soul, like the drops of the ocean arise in the ocean. Now this aham tattva and mahat tattva contain the three qualities. From the three qualities arise what is called the subtle elements of taste, touch. Taste, touch, sight, hearing and smell. They're called tanmatras. And from these arise the fire, air, water, earth and ether. From ether comes hearing, from fire comes sight, from air comes touch, from water comes taste, and from smell, from earth comes smell. So there is, see, you see here, there is the evolution of elements in the senses. Elements in the senses are intermingled. Every one of the element has its corresponding sense. So, from the three qualities arise these subtle elements, and the corresponding senses are evolved, and corresponding organs of action. What are the organs of action? What are the sense, five senses that we have, sight, hearing, taste, touch, and smell. Organs of action, hands, feet, locomotion, speech, elimination, reproduction, and the mind. So we have 16 categories. These 16 categories are common everywhere throughout the universe. That's what Patanjali says here. The whole universe is made up of these, what? Three qualities, elements, and organs of action, producing visible and invisible form for the soul, I am a consciousness, to dwell, for its experience in emancipation. Unity of nature. You see here unity of nature. Now when we view this, what do we find? We find that it is impossible for us to separate ourselves from others, from the whole, from our fellow creatures, from our fellow men. We are bound together by indissoluble bond of brotherhood. So much so that you cannot hurt any one creature or your fellow men without hurting the whole and hurting yourself. Just like any one part of the body can be hurt without affecting the whole body. It's a very important ethical principle. Therefore, there must be, because of unity of nature, there must be an absolutely just, harmonious law or justice. Where does the justice exist? The very essence of our being is made up of that justice, universal justice. How does that justice act? When we act, it produces a disturbance. Because it must affect everyone. If you act in a way that, you know, it obstructs the harmonious natural evolution of species to higher life, and thwarts it. When we act selfishly and wickedly, it does it. Not only we degrade ourselves, we obstruct the progression of other beings. So what happens? We have created a great disturbance. And the law of karma or justice acts in a way that it incessantly acting to restore the disturbed harmony. When the disturbed harmony gets restored, how does it get restored? It gets restored through and by the individual or individuals who produce the disturbance. It converges on those points which cause the disturbance and they feel it as pain. If the disturbance has been, if the causes produced by the action has been in conformity or in harmony with the harmony of life, the reaction comes to them as help, as happiness, as fortune. All the misfortune, calamities, we invite it on ourselves, collectively and individually. Unity of nature. So this is one aspect. So the whole of the lower kingdoms of nature, the mineral, the plant, the animal, souls evolving, they look up to man who stands at the apex of evolutionary ladder for their progress. Man is a macrocosm for them. Just as the universal self, the heavenly man, is a macrocosm for us. Man is an intermediate between the lower kingdoms of nature and the supreme soul of the world. He links spirit to matter. And he has to elevate, ennoble, etherealize and help the lower kingdoms of nature to evolve. And if he acts irresponsibly, instead of helping nature, he will be obstructing nature, and all the calamities and disturbance of the world is due to this. So it entails tremendous responsibility on every human being. Now we'll stop here and then there is nearly 15 minutes. We could have gone on a little further, but we'll stop here because after having thrown some seeds of thought, you know, probably it will work in your mind. Many questions may arise. So we'll respond to them. Please, sir, speak a little loud because I'm hard of hearing. And then whatever you want to say, if you make it short and clear, and it will be helpful.
Sir, man's sufferings, many people, the sufferings are vary from person to person. That is because the suffering also bring a harmony overall. The suffering of an individual man is related to past karma or present this one. It is to balance the nature or balance the this one.
It is through
harmony, to bring the harmony.
I understand. You seem to say that the suffering that comes to us is a process of restoration of harmony. Is that the question?
Yes, sir.
Yes, very much. Very much. Whether it is happiness or sorrow or your fortune or misfortune, pain or pleasure, that comes to us in life is exact, mathematically accurate result of our past action. There is not one misfortune or accident in our life which cannot be traced to the causes we produce ourselves at some time or the other past. It can never come. The cause and effect relationship. So as long as we act in harmony with nature to do our proper dharma, the dharma of the human being, so long you are acting in harmony. You'll be aiding the whole nature in its march to higher life and yourself progressing and helping your fellow man to progress. It's a very important point.
Do you mean that next, after doing karma, you will refine himself, purity will come after doing the karma and whatever the past deeds, if he will start declining and afterwards he will go to the better life?
The Shay understands your question is that the end result of all these experiences is moving to higher life. Correct. You are right. You know, as souls we have passed through the lower forms of life. We have come to the human stage. Now that's not the end of it. Now we have to, through our own effort, not an automatic process, but acting responsibly, thinking responsibly with knowledge and discrimination and learning in the school of life, we have to evolve by our own effort to higher stages of, higher spheres of existence, higher life, higher planes of, the whole humanity is moving to higher planes, towards the soul from which it emanated. Others may be having some questions. Yeah, please.
Yeah, actually I have a question which relates to reputation of home where there is a formation of positive samskaras, right? There is also, Patanjali says, reputation of a mantra will elicited deity, respect people that mantra. So, is this chanting of home, reputation of home, which creates positive motive in our
minds?
So,
how
does it help in our evolution
and
progress?
Prasanna, can you repeat?
The question seems to be this. In the Patanjali Yoga aphorism, it is said that repetition of a mantra, repetition of a mantra will evoke a certain deity attached to that mantra, point number one. And secondly, repetition of the word om results in positive samskaras. So, does this really help?
Does it really help?
Is that...
The Patanjali Yoga aphorisms, it is mentioned, one of the disciplines is to meditate on the sacred syllable om. Right? Now, what Theosophy teaches is that anyone practice mentioned in the Patanjali Yoga aphorism, apart from the whole of the discipline, will not be of use. First of all, we must understand the philosophy of yoga. And once we understand the philosophy of yoga, the ethics based on that philosophy, it is very scientific. Only when we have grasped it, then we will be able to make a good use of the aphorisms. Now, merely repetition of any mantra will not be much unless and until we you know, or until we thoroughly understand the nature of our true self, who we are, why we are here, what our true nature is, what the universe is about, what is our dharma. This whole philosophy should be understood. The meaning and purpose of life. And the discrimination between the transitory and the permanent. The perishable and the imperishable. The true and the false. See, this elementary study, understanding and mastering the philosophy of the science of higher life is the first thing to be done before we take up any practice. This is a very important thing. Now, if you see Patanjali Yoga aphorisms, if you read the Sanskrit slokas, it is very difficult to understand. Because first of all, the language is, Sanskrit language used in it is peculiar. It is not like what you read in Upanishads and all that. It is a little different. And it is very aphoristic, short. What Mr. Judge has done, he has not, literal translation he has not done. He has rendered it in a way which is comprehensible to the Western man. We are all Westerners. What do we know of Eastern philosophy? We have become Westernized. It is applicable to us also. So, and in the preface to the Yoga of Aphorisms, he explains what is mind, what is soul, what is will. Are they the same? And you know, this is a very important thing that people understand. And what is the purpose of life? And if you read Yoga Aphorisms of Patanjali, in the light of what he has explained in the preface, and beautiful rendering, when he renders Yoga Aphorisms of Patanjali in English, he captures this, the thought of the sage, and puts it in a way that we understand. So, to our friend, we recommend study Yoga Aphorisms of Patanjali, its philosophy and ethics well. And then, you know, the whole discipline as a whole should be understood. And its practice is not easy, but once we make this preliminary exercise and begin to practice it, the concentration of mind described there, it'll be of help. But most important thing is ethics. If you do not, if you are not well grounded in ethics, in the universal brotherhood, in our responsibility towards others, if you are not of of loftier aspiration and unselfishness, then it will not be much use. That is the first thing to be done. There is another question.
In continuation to the point you are making there regarding this question, you said that it won't be of much use if you just recite a mantra or just recite this syllable unless you have studied it in a comprehensive way.
Yeah, yeah.
But is there any harm?
Is there any harm? There may be harm, there may not be harm. See, if a person lives a life of the world loosely, right? You go to pub and have a drink, you have a club life, and loose moral life you live. And then you chant mantras, and you recite Om, it will have, it will definitely do harm. Buddha teaches us to effect purity of three avenues of action: speech, mind, body. Body purification does not occur by doing asanas and all that, breathing, you don't. It will help you you know, controlling some diseases and all that, ailments. You have back pain, all that will be relieved. But that's not purity of body. Purity of body comes from purity of thought and purity of motive and intent. Selfish motive and selfish intent is impurity of thought, impurity of mind. And our bias, our desires, our selfishness, all that are impurities. So our right earnest should be to, you know, to purify our minds. What is meant by purity of heart? Purity of your aspirations, purity of your desires. It must be for the good of all. This kind of a higher awareness and, you know, impulse to make an effort for self-purification comes only through study of esoteric philosophy. Study is very important. Without study, no practice will be of any help. If it is of no help, that's one thing. It may even do harm. So we have come to the end of time. We will stop here. And then next Sunday, on 22nd, there will be another talk here on the subject, Wisdom in Action. Thank you.